Sherman Act outlaws conspiracy and restraint of trade, and I forgot the second clause, but basically it's really all it says. It's very vague. It's been held to mean price fixing of some sort, like a cartel. It doesn't mention anything. It's very vague. It's like a two sentence. And then the Clayton Act in 1913-14 adds some stuff and creates the Federal Trade Commission. So most of the antitrust law is simply accretions of decisions, the antitrust courts, the courts, Department of Justice, and the Federal Trade Commission. They can do whatever they want. I mean, basically, they declare anything monopolistic or anything, merger. It's purely administrative fiat. At the peak of the antitrust hysteria, which really came in the 1930s, 40s, or 50s, approximately, anything could be considered and was considered monopolistic. If you charge a price the same as your competitors, it's called collusion. As we know, that most prices tend to be the same, obviously. Hershey bars or Nestle bars will be the same, will be about the same, otherwise one of them is going to be in trouble. If you charge a price lower than your competitors, considered predatory price cutting and unfair competition. If you charge a price higher than your competitors, considered monopolistic. So, whatever you did, it can be considered monopolistic. So it's purely arbitrary on the part of the government. There was no rule of law. There was no statute you can interpret in any, you know, rational sense. And in those days, of course, I can't get into it in this course particularly, but they actually took seriously the economic model of perfect competition. If the competition in the market wasn't, quote, perfect, unquote, which meant if any firm could affect its market in any way, by making a better product, by competing more actively, something that somehow meant it was monopolistic. So, in that basis, you can outlaw everything. And so, they could selectively then move in, and right now, almost all antitrust suits are private. 90% of antitrust charges are made not by the government, by other firms in industry. And even the government ones are at the behest of other firms. And usually what it is, almost exclusively, is inefficient firms are trying to screw their competitors by getting the government to hobble their competition. So if IBM does better than Control Data Corporation or something, Control Data will file an antitrust suit. It's unfair, blah, blah, blah. They can get away with it. Either they get away with it, in which case they cripple the competition, or else they make it's like a blackmail thing. They make the other guys settle out of court for a handsome fee. Most private antitrust suits are settled out of court with a poor victim has to pay up. It's really like blackmail with the government being the enforcer. Anyway, good.
When you have a merger,
yeah. No, if you raise it, in other words, if the merger, I mean, a merger could be just for efficiency purposes. I mean, usually, yeah.
You have to keep the price constant. All you have to get them down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. No, well, it depends I think Texas Air did bust it. They just don't hire, when a contract runs out or whatever, they just don't hire union workers. They hire non-union machinists or pilots or whatever it is. No. That's not your fault. You can't deny them a vote or something. In other words, if they can call for an election, collective bargaining election. But if they don't have a collective bargaining election, in many of these cases, the workers wouldn't vote for a union anyway. And so, in many cases, the non-union workers are people who can't get union jobs anyway because they've been squeezed out. See, because, you know, unions push the supply curve of workers to the left. Right? They exclude a whole bunch of people. So this is a machinist union, let's say. Union machinists are getting a lot higher pay than non-union machinists, but non-union machinists can't get into the union. The jobs are frozen out. It's control of entry. So you can turn to a pool in many cases of non-union machinists, pilots, stewardesses, and all that. And just then once you hire them, they'd be in favor of keeping the union act. They realize that jobs are at stake. Especially in the airlines industry, they're all going bankrupt anyway if it's excessive union wages. See, what happened in the airline industry was all monopolistic. The CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board, from the very beginning in the 1930s, monopolized the airline industry and assigned routes. In other words, only Eastern Airlines could fly from Boston to New York or something. That's it. Anybody else gets flies gets is outlawed. And so they restricted, drastically, and they assigned routes, and they drastically restricted competition. They only let a few airlines in the industry. For a long time, for example, only Pan Am could fly in the Pacific. Nobody else could do it. It was illegal. So by doing that, they first cut production and raised prices. But after 30 years of this stuff, the airline gets monopolistic. The cost gets bid up. They pay excessive wage rates to pilots and stewardesses and all that. The costs go way up. They get lazy. And so they wound up not making money anyway, even with the regulation, even with the monopoly, they lost money. In other words, in the long run, in many, like with the railroads, monopoly, puts the boot to the whole industry. So in the case of the airlines, only United Airlines, I think, fought against deregulation finally in the late 70s. So all the other airlines realized, look, we're going down the tubes anyway, we might as well try private market. And so, of course, interesting about deregulation, by the way, it shows the economic theory in action. Nobody, no airline economics expert or airline expert predicted what would happen. In other words, deregulation came around 1978, 79. Nobody realized what the change of pattern would be. Nobody realized it'd be spokes instead of the spoke hub stuff. Just the way it worked. I mean, in other words, in the old days, if you flew from New York to San Francisco, you almost always flew nonstop. Right? That's it. Now, very few people fly nonstop. Now, it's almost always a hub situation. You go to Denver or something, everybody flies into Denver and they fly out. It works that way. Somehow it's more efficient to get these other cities coming in. So that's the way it went. Nobody predicted this, what would happen. At any rate, some mergers, in this case, they're going to try to operate without the machinist union. And what happened with these non-union airlines, like Texas Air, is that they pay much lower salaries to stewardesses, pilots, et cetera. They're getting enormous salaries, these people, enormous. And so now they're being brought down to earth, so to speak. One of my colleagues, which remain nameless, the Marxist, who was married to a stewardess of Pan Am, and he was very much against deregulation, not only because he's a Marxist, but also because he realized this would lead to the lower prices for passengers and the end of the monopoly rent, so to speak, monopoly wage rate enjoyed by stewardesses of Pan Am. Flight attendants, that's what he's supposed to say now. At any rate, to get back to the sugar thing, I was in the middle of the sugar trust and its saga. I'm going to do a few more of these examples and then point out the significance of all this in relation to other historians, various historians. Do you remember the sugar, when I left off on Tuesday, the sugar trust had again merged with Arbuckle. Arbuckle had moved in to compete with the American Sugar Refining Company, which was an attempted monopoly. And they finally, and the prices went down again and so forth, so they finally absorbed, they had an agreement between Havemeyer, who was the head of American Sugar Refining Trust, and Arbuckle, and they wound up with another big cartel, 1901. So by 1902, they formed a new American, all the mergers were called American Sugar Refining Company. 1902, they wound up with a larger one with 90% of the output of the refined sugar. Do you think that'd be enough? There are only three independents left, three small independent sugar producers. And they jack the price up. Of course, profits go up. They jack it up from 4.6 cents per hundredweight, I guess it was, to 5.3. And they think they're doing great. And then again, the same damn thing happened. They start again with new competitors. In other words, they cut production and raise the price and raise profit. As soon as they do that, new competitors come and increase their production. And the price has to fall again. And once again, it falls by 1905 to about 4.5 cents, back down to what it was before. And now you have new competitors, and now the sugar trust by 1904 is only 70% of the total output. and the whole cartel, the whole merger system collapses at that point and doesn't come back again until World War I. Once again, just as in the steel industry, where the government recartelizes the industry on behalf of alleged war effort, the whole merger system once again collapses in the sugar refining. And it repeats in industry after industry. I'll just give a few more examples of this. It's fascinating how time and time again they try a cart, they merge, they have a big new merger, and they try to have a monopoly. And the whole point of a monopoly, of course, is to try to cut production and raise prices and raise profits. As soon as they do that, new competitors come in, they're back down again. There's new competitors, and it's like pushing back the waves or something. It never works. By 1914, the sugar trust is down to 54%. Total share of total output. So prices are back down, the whole thing is lower, etc., etc. Habermeyer, who made a statement, as you remember, the tariff is the mother of trusts, repeated the statement, and he made it, you know, repeated it at length for Congress. And what he said was that we never would have tried even to have a merger, a monopoly, without a high tariff wall to keep out foreign competition. He said the merger was built up, he said, under, quote, enormous protection. Without the tariff, I doubt if we should have dared to take the risk of forming the trust. I certainly should not have risked all I had in a trust unless the business had been protected as it was by the tariff. So it was a very clear statement by one of the top monopolists, so to speak, or trust persons, that the tariff is the mother of trust, and he, of course, made the statement, his quote. At any rate, there's also the leather trust, which is kind of interesting, because the leather company, U.S. Leather Company, when it was formed in 1893, had higher capitalization, was a bigger company even than Standard Oil Trust. It was a huge company. We don't think much about leather, but in the leather business, there's the sole leather industry, which was highly competitive. This is what we're talking about. Sole leather. It was leather for, I guess, soles of shoes. And a lot of small firms, there was very little capital required to enter, so there was a lot of easy entry into the industry. And five of the largest leather firms, or tanners, I guess they're called, firms that make leather. The five largest ones, and mostly concentrated in New York and Pennsylvania in that period, so they're fairly close together. Like the brewery industry was concentrated in Brooklyn and New York, etc. They all got together to form the U.S. Leather Company in 1893. It had a capitalization, its total assets capitalization, was $130 million. It was the largest firm in the country at that point, largest corporation in the country. Standard Oil at that point was only $102 million, the whole Standard Oil Trust. So, because it doesn't get the play of the oil industry, but it's the largest corporation in the country. At that point, it controlled, at that point, 58% of the sole leather with that merger, 58% of tan to sole leather, I guess is the correct term for it. 72% of hemlock leather, 30% of oak leather, but the overall 58%, and get into the details. So what happens with this thing? Here's the biggest company in the country, controls 58% of the output. What happens to it? Total flopperoo. Makes losses. It starts off immediately with a loss of $1.3 million in the first year. It thought it could cut production and raise prices. It thought it would have an economy of large scale. Didn't work. It made losses. The profits were low. The stocks collapsed. There were no dividends. Stock prices collapsed, etc. Prices continue to be competitive. There's too much competition. New competition coming in. And the small tanners began to outcompete the large tanners when they try to raise the price. And finally, in 1904, the thing went bankrupt. In other words, after 11 years of losses, the mighty U.S. leather company went bankrupt, kaput, finished. Again, another merger going down the drain. Same way with the cornstarch industry. Cornstarch industry had a big merger, try to create a trust. And they had 70% of the cornstarch industry, again, a very large factory. Again, there's a severe competition comes up, and the whole thing collapses once more. Again, there's another merger. 1900 is a further merger. This is 1893. A bigger merger, and they had 90% of the starch in the industry, 90% of the cornstarch. What then happens is, 90% of the starch, cornstarch got to be so expensive. In other words, they have 90%. This is the so-called United Starch, the National Starch Company, merger company. So naturally, in order, the whole point of the merger is to be able to cut production, raise prices. As soon as they do that, cornstarch gets so expensive that industries using starch start using other kinds of starch. In other words, cornstarch now becomes uncompetitive compared to the other starch. I think. I think potato starch So people start using mills and factories which use starch as raw material, start shifting from cornstarch to potato starch, and the whole thing, again, collapses. Independent mills spring up, either with potato starch or a new cornstarch mill, using a new process, hydraulic process, which is brand new, lowering the cost of manufacture. The profits of the National Starch Company begin to collapse, and in a few years, they're down to 40%, from 90% of the total output to 40%. So once again, this thing is heartwarming, and what's going to happen is very fast. Merged monopolies collapse time and time again, industry after industry. And the same thing is just a process of illustrating economic law at work. Same thing happens in the glucose industry, which is similar to the starch industry. The same damn thing. Monopoly after monopoly, merged monopoly after merged monopoly. Doesn't work. In 1897, they formed the big merger of the glucose sugar refining company, $40 million company, with 85% of the glucose. 1897. And at first they had high profits. They raised the price. They cut production. Everything was hunky-dory. And very soon, new people come into it. They said, hey, I got high profits in glucose. Let's build a new glucose factory. New glucose firms come in, the Illinois Sugar Refining Company, the New York Glucose Company, et cetera, which, by the way, was put in by Rockefeller as an investment. And so with new machinery, by 1901, the glucose company is back down at 45% of the output, and they have to cut prices. They make a lot of losses, and their stock collapses, and bingo. And in 1902, they try another consolidation, a new mighty merger of the big glucose company, the mighty corn products company, now the corn products refining company, which now has 80% of the glucose. This is 1902. And corn products. And again, the same thing happens, the same sort of story. They expect they had high profit. They scrap a lot of their plants. Hey, we're going to take a lot of plants out of production. Cut production, raise prices, and again, new starch factories come in, glucose factories, better ones, newer ones, Peel Brothers, Warner Company, the mighty corn products company begins to collapse, profits decline, high cost of corn limits the market, heavy losses, the stock collapses, and the whole company more or less goes under. By 1903, they're only producing, 1 year later, they're producing only 45% of the glucose market, from 80% to 45% in 1 year. 1906, they try another mighty new merger, called the Corn Products Refining Company, a $91 million company with 74% of the product, and very shortly that. But what happens to them is they realize they couldn't raise the price. They kept low prices, so the company kept on, but they didn't achieve any kind of monopoly price. It's fine with me. You know, they just stick to low cost of production and distribution. So any company to succeed had to not be a monopolist. In other words, had to act as if they're competitors. They were competitive. Same thing happens with the Gunpowder Trust, another not too well-studied trust. The DuPont Company, which has always been the major gunpowder company. Before they were producing nylons and stuff, they started as arms and gunpowder manufacturers. And DuPont led the way in 1872 to form a mighty 43-corporation merger, a mighty gunpowder trust. And they formed it by... not by predatory price cutting. Once again, they never try to undercut their competition. What they did is they simply bought them out at a very high fee. And leaving only a couple of companies, and once again, the whole thing begins to, their share of the market begins to collapse. And finally, they just had to go, they just went, by the time they dissolved by 1911, after many years of struggling to maintain, get some kind of monopoly price out of it. Which they never succeeded in. By the way, in the case of the Gunpowder Trust, they had 230. They had I think many firms. They had many firms. Yeah, they had about 43 firms in this merger. They couldn't prevent their own part, their own plants, their own different subsections of the companies from cheating, quote cheating unquote. The salesmen, like once again, the sales vice presidents, the sales managers, are constantly offering rebates and discounts to get more people for themselves and for their department. Even though it was one merged company, they didn't act as if they were, they were acting as, they were salesmen. They wanted to make more sales, and they competed against each other. They couldn't even stop that, and much less external competition. They couldn't stop internal competition from the sales managers. And then, of course, new entrants come in and help compete with Untitled Trust. The whole thing had to collapse. And a general study of these trusts, okay, of nearly 100 trusts or mergers formed in 1899 to 1900, for example, they have of 100, they have 100 merged so-called trusts. We'll define a trust as being a merged attempted monopoly. Okay? 1899 to 1900. In 1 year, three quarters of these firms were not paying dividends. In other words, they were losing money, basically. They were in bad financial shape. And only 1 year after they were formed, there are many other, several other statistics I'll mention on this thing, but the promoters' hopes were not realized in most cases. New competition comes in, et cetera, et cetera. Coco points out of the 50 largest corporations in 1909, for example, in 20 years, 20 had dropped out of the 50 largest, and there was a very high turnover of large companies. Coco has a lot of very good stuff. His first two chapters on mergers and failure mergers are very good. The other very good person, even better, Coco's book, by the way, came as a thunderclap, and it came out in 1960, so I'll point out in a minute. Before Coco, I think Coco was, what, 1960-something? 65, something like that. Anyway, 1960s. Before that, the best study of mergers was made by a guy named Arthur Dewing, which nobody paid any attention to. Arthur S. Dewing. D-E-W-I-N-G. He'd written a book called Corporate Promotions and Reorganizations, I think 1906 or something like that. And then he'd written a journal article, a scholarly journal article in 1911, studying what had happened to these mergers, a random sample. And then he wrote an excellent textbook on corporate finance called Financial Policy of Corporations, which went into about 20 editions. I think the first edition was like 1920 and continued for about 30 years. It might still be in print for all I know. And it's a marvelous book. It's not really a textbook. It's chock full of footnotes and all sorts of other great stuff. But nobody ever read this except corporate finance people. I mean, the economists didn't read it, historians didn't read it. It was sort of isolated in the mainstream. Anyway, Dewing, that's probably the best study. Coco is a second, comes in second. So what Dewing showed is that you had two trust waves, two merger waves. First, the smallest one, the late 1880s, early 1890s. That was the first one. And then the biggest one, as I pointed out, was late 1880s, 1890s. The largest one was 1898, 1901. That was the most, by far the biggest, when most of the mergers took place. What he did was he took for example, he said 130, in this second wave, 130 mergers were made. It was 130 trusts, 130 different industries. Climax, of course, by U.S. Steel Corporation, which was 1901, at a capitalization of $1.3 billion. And I've already mentioned about the steel industry. The Morgan. And what he did was he took a random sample of 35 industries and went into detail what happened to them. What happened to them after they? What was the expectation of the promoters before they were merged? What happened to them afterward? A year after, 5 years, 10 years afterward? He also asked the question: why did it stop in 1901? Why was there a sudden cessation, sudden stopping of mergers in 1901? It wasn't any kind of antitrust stuff. And he said, well, they turned out badly. They just didn't work. They didn't suppress competition. They didn't realize big economies of scale. See, they thought one of their theories was if a large company is more efficient than a small company, then a very, very large company must be even more efficient. Well, of course, it didn't work that way. There are limits to economies of scale, and they tapped them, especially by this kind of artificial merger. Their stocks declined steadily. They made losses. They had new competitors coming in, all the stuff I've talked about. Few of them paid any dividends at all. Most of them lost money. The shares of output of the industry declined steadily. Many of them actually went bankrupt. They just collapsed totally. Those that didn't collapse had to cut back on keep declining steadily, like U.S. Steel, which has been a miserable shape ever since. So he studied, let's say, a random sample of 35 of these trusts, and he found out, for example, that the average of the 35, 25% of these mergers earn more in the first year before the trust. Excuse me. Yeah, just earn more just before the trust than in the year afterward. So then in 1 year after. In other words, if you take 100 companies forming a trust, let's say, in some industry, you take their average rate of return, average rate of profit, just before they form the trust, and compare it with the trust after it was formed, the average drop was 25%, drop in profits. After 10 years, it's also more than the average earnings of 10 years later. So you have 10 years of the trust, it's still earning less than the individual company did before the trust. The estimates of the promoters and bankers who form the trusts were 50% higher than the actual earnings in the first year, and much higher over the first 10 years. In other words, inflated estimates. You asked about water stock. In other words, they say we earned $10 million next year and only earned $5 million. That's a 50% drop over the expectation of the promoters. Of the 35, or look at it another way, of the 35 trusts that he's doing studied, Thirteen had positive earnings in the first year. And 13 had first year earnings equal or greater than the pre-trust earnings. Those higher first year earnings are the same. 22 dropped in earnings, lower earnings. It's the same for the whole first 10-year period. Most of the trusts had much lower earnings after they formed than before. Only four had earnings equal to anticipation. Only four earnings were anticipated. Equal to anticipation. Looking another way, earnings after the trust were expected to be 40% higher than, on the average, the earnings after the trust were expected to be 40% higher than before the trust. Actually, they were 20% less in the first year and 10% less over the first couple, several years. So that gives you another way of looking at it. They're expected to be 40% higher in your former trust. They expect that the promoters expect to have 40% higher. It actually dropped from 10 to 20%. So some of the reasons he goes into is that, as I say, just because a larger firm is more economical and a smaller firm doesn't mean a very large firm would be more economical. It depends, especially if it doesn't grow organically, especially if it's artificially imposed by this sort of promotion. it turns out, for example, that management or entrepreneurship is very scarce. The range of judgment is very scarce, is limited. One guy over a huge number of, aside from the fact that a new competitor is popping up, you know, the range of individual initiative is limited. Managerial ability is very scarce, et cetera, et cetera. Also, in many cases, the loyalty of the managers will weaken. See, what usually happens is that they merge, the 20 firms merge into one. The guy used to be the owner or the president of one firm, becomes now the manager of that division. Well, he doesn't care that much anymore as a manager than he did as an owner. also, the salesmen are demoralized. They're supposed to now restrict their sales. They don't like that. I've already mentioned that. And the larger size often makes them worse competitors compared to smaller, more mobile owners and much more innovative. One example of that, I don't know if I mentioned it already, but the current recent years have been great examples of very large firms of so-called monopolies or virtual monopolies that have become uncreative, bureaucratic, et cetera, et cetera. did I mention Xerox and Polaroid yet? That's a classic example. After World War II, in the United States at least, there was a virtual monopoly of photography by Eastman Kodak. And Dr. Land, when the discoverer of Polaroid camera, comes to this great new discovery, comes to Eastman Kodak and says, look, I have this great thing, and he offered, of course, to sell it to Eastman Kodak, and their experts went over and they said, it won't work. It won't be economic, it won't work, that's it. So he had to go and get friends together and get a small bank loan or whatever and start the thing up on his own company. I wish, of course, I had had 10 shares of the original Polaroid Corporation. Same thing happened to the guy who invented Xerox, I forget his name. Anyway, same damn thing happened. He goes to one of the great revolutions in photography, right? He goes to the Eastman Kodak, won't work, it's uneconomic, blah, blah, blah. He has to start his own Xerox Corporation. The rest of his history. Actually, he's originally Haloid Xerox, a teeny company. And of course, I wish I had 10 shares of that. Another fantastic success story. So once again, the monopolist, the big business, doesn't see the situation. You start off a teeny firm, you outcompete these guys for the wall. there's an excellent book. There's several books on this if you're interested. An excellent book by John Jukes and others, Jukes and other people, called Sources of Invention. It's a marvelous book. I'm not sure it's in print anymore, but it took all the top inventions of the 20th century, about 80 of them or something, and found out where they were invented, what sort of conditions, and it found out almost every case it was done by either an individual inventor or a small firm. It was not done by the big research laboratory. Big research laboratories seem to be much better for development after somebody else has invented it. They can then process it and apply it. But for actual inventions, they were a pack of losers in this whole situation. All of the top inventions of the 20th century, including Xerox and Polaroid and penicillin and God knows what else. And a whole bunch of stuff. Basic oxygen process and steel. All these things start in very small laboratories where the people are flexible and not bureaucratic, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing that happens is the peddler, as we'll see in a minute, in the retail industry. Get into that in a minute too. Where in many cases in retail firms, smaller businesses can outcompete larger ones very easily. You see the peddlers, for example, your local florists are hunted down like rats by the police. They can very beautifully outcompete the official florists. The official orthodox florist, so to speak, charge $10 for a bunch of flowers. You get it for $2, better ones, on the corner florist. And he's mobile, he can get stuff easily, he can get in out of the rain, he doesn't have to be, he can take the right corners and the right spots. He's not fixed, he doesn't have to pay fixed rent, he's not fixed in one particular, if it's raining that day, he doesn't have to show up. All these things makes the peddler, who has almost no capital, notice the peddler only has one day's worth of equipment, makes him very able to outcompete larger stores. As a result of that, the history of the retail industry, I just start that today, but the history of the retail industry in the United States is a whole history of constant attempts by the established firms to render illegal, to cripple and outcompete by law their more smaller mobile competitors. In almost every city and town in the country, even now, peddlers are illegal. They're still illegal here. There are severe licensing requirements. Every once in a while, the mayor tries to crack down on them. They have to outlaw these evil peddlers because they can outcompete retail stores. Well, tough. It's a great thing. Why shouldn't they outcompete them? Why shouldn't the consumers be able to get scarves and pocketbooks and all that for much cheaper? Watches are cheaper than the established official firms. So the fact that you have more capital doesn't necessarily mean you're better to competitively. In many cases, you're worse off because you're stuck in this fixed location, for example. And many of the immigrant groups in the United States came in, they rose up, immigrants in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that came to New York with no money at all, nothing in their pocket, and they get one day's worth of stuff, of capital, so to speak, one day's worth of peddling equipment, flowers or cloth or whatever it is, and they start with that and they rise up very quickly. And profits, plow back the profits, finally get a push cart. Push cart, of course, is a massive amount of capital compared to just carrying a thing in a suitcase or whatever. And they wind up quite wealthy in that way. And so, but now we current low-income groups are find it difficult to do that because they need heavy license requirements. They're hunted down by the police, etc., driven out. In New York, the mayor of New York usually says that it's unaesthetic. The major argument against peddlers is that the streets are no longer beautiful. And New York, you may say a lot about New York streets, Beauty is not one of them. Aesthetics is not one of our major one of our major attributes. The idea that somehow the streets have to be cleansed by getting rid of peddlers is pretty extremely phony. Anyway, Dewing winds up, I think, a marvelous quote from Dewing after he's summing up his study of the 35 mergers, what happened to them, etc. And he says this, quote, "I've been impressed throughout by the powerlessness of mere aggregates of capital to hold monopoly. The powerlessness of just because they have a lot of capital equipment. I've been impressed, too, by the tremendous importance of individual innate ability, or its lack, in determining the success or failure of any enterprise. With these observations in mind, one may hazard the belief that whatever, quote, fuss problem, unquote, exists, will work out its own solution. The doom of the inefficient waits on no legislative regulation. It is rather delayed thereby. Restrictive regulation will perpetuate the inefficient corporation by furnishing an artificial prop to support natural weakness. It will hamper the efficient by impeding the free play of personal ambition." It's a beautiful statement that without government intervention, just letting it rip, without any kind of regulation or control, you'll wind up with enterprise being successful. In other words, regardless of how much capital the person's got, he's got ability to foresee what's going on, to step into the market, to compete. He or she will do so rather than just aggregates of capital. And I want to turn next, I just start this today, about the history of the retail industry in the United States. I mean, one constant attempt of new innovations, repeating itself, with the orthodox current established retailers trying desperately to crush the new competition by law, turning the government to outlaw them. Right now, as I say, peddlers are almost illegal almost everywhere, except with severe license requirements. It starts in the early 19th century. You have to go back to that. Remember, in the early 19th century, there were no roads. Okay? So there were very little, there were no traveling salesmen, there's nothing, there's no way, you can't travel. So what you had was merchants in central markets who were offering goods. And once a year, the out-of-town buyers would come in. They managed to make their way to New York or whatever, they still do in many cases in the garment industry, to look at the samples of equipment and buy them and carry them home. Okay? That was the sort of pre-Civil War, pre-1850s. Situation. So it was very little standardization. It was a very haphazard kind of setup. In the 1850s and 1860s, with the railroad coming in, a new kind of marketing technology enters the field of retail, namely the traveling salesman, who would take his sample case and travel around and go to different merchants, retail merchants, and sell his wares. The traveling salesman was met by the wholesale merchants in the towns. In other words, in Detroit or Peoria or whatever, you have all these wholesale merchants. Traveling salesman would come from New York and go to the retailers, go straight to the retailers and compete with their local wholesale merchants. Local wholesale merchants met this whole development with hysteria, with hatred. The traveling salesman, of course, had no capital except his suitcase. And so there's a whole series of state and city licensing laws that crush the traveling salesman, making, for example, very high license fees, severe anti-peddler laws. And every little town has its own license tax. In other words, it would say something like this: anybody who sells anything in our town, doesn't live in our town, has to pay a license fee of, $20 a year, which is enormous. The poor traveling salesman has to pay $20 a year every town he visits, which makes it totally prohibitive. As a matter of fact, the average traveling salesman is making $2,500 a year in those days. He had to pay a license fee out of that of over $1,000, which means like almost 40% of his income is absorbed in license fees. Obviously, this is not going to work. So what you had then was a series of evasions. In other words, the peddlers are trying to evade, the traveling salesmen are trying to evade the license fees one way or the other, sneak into town, sell their stuff in retail and get out before they're caught, or else they have phony employees. In other words, they get some resident merchant, like some retail merchant, to quote hire them unquote for 2 weeks. They wouldn't be illegal. They wouldn't have to pay a license fee. They have phony employee relationship, or they just say skip town, dodging the tax collector, or they bribe the local tax collector. Of course, they have a black market traveling salesman. The result of all this is the traveling salesman was always in a state of semi-legality. Sometimes he was jailed. He'd sent went to jail for not non-payment of the license fee. So he became a disreputable figure. And as a result of that, the famous traveling salesman farmer's daughter's jokes came in. I don't know if it's still going around, but when I was growing up, it was still a standard dirty joke of the epoch, of the traveling salesman joke. The reason why the traveling salesman was a state of semi-legality. They're always disreputable. They're half jail, half the time. They're skipping the law. At any rate, this goes on for about 20 or 30 years, this kind of nonsense, trying to use the law to repress the traveling salesman concept. Finally, after about 30 years or so, by about 1880s, the pressure comes to and is finally repealed. Actually, the Supreme Court finally declares them unconstitutional. But the pressure comes from several sources, kind of interesting. First place, the retail merchants want this. They're getting cheaper wholesale products. Also, another thing that happens is the wholesalers themselves start employing traveling salesmen. In other words, a wholesaler in Detroit will start sending traveling salesmen out to their region. So they don't want to have their people outlawed and paying heavy license fees. So in other words, traveling salesmen now begin to be used by the wholesale merchants themselves, and they start shifting to support repeal. This happens in Baltimore, happens in Philadelphia, in Louisville, in Atlanta. All these sort of medium-sized cities start shifting, and the salesmen start forming their own associations to pressure for lobby for repeal. So you have the shift by the local merchants and the regional merchants and the salesmen association. Finally, the Supreme Court takes notice of this, and the whole thing goes down the chute. After 30 years of repression of the poor traveling salesmen, the thing is finally over. made decisions in the 1870s and 80s. So anyway, finally the traveling salesmen were accepted. They're no longer disreputable. There's no longer high license fees. They're part of the industry. But again, hysteria hits. It doesn't take much longer for a new innovation to come. For example, two big things happen. One is that about 1895 comes the department store. You can't imagine the hysteria with which department stores were met. Department stores are unfair, they're evil, they're out-competing poor mom-and-pop stores, stores that only sell one or two things. Department stores, they have many floors, makes them unfair, they have 10 floors, the other stores have only one floor, and so there's a tremendous attacks on Gimbel's and Macy's and other department stores, and the retailers would condemn department stores as being, they said, quote, department stores would, quote, result in oppression of the public. Can I get this? They're claiming it's for the public interest to suppress the outlaw department stores. It would result in oppression of the public by suppressing competition and causing the consumer in the end to pay higher prices and ultimately create a monopoly. But here's the argument. Here's the department stores, Macy's, Gimbel's, etc., which are now efficient out-competing retail stores. If you allow them to do that, they will eventually push all the retail stores out of business and they will then cut prices, cut production and raise prices. So for the interest of the consumers, we should outlaw the department stores now. Notice the logic of this. Because there might be eventually a monopoly an efficient monopoly by department stores. Therefore, if we create an inefficient monopoly right now, screw the consumers now by outlawing department stores. That's the logic of it. In Germany, there were compulsory cartel system from about 1880 to about 19, from the end of World War II, more or less. And after World War II was over, Germany no longer had a compulsory cartel system. It was more or less free market, more or less relatively free market. So the former cartelists had an argument to the German parliament, and they said as follows, about 1950. I remember reading it somewhere in a clipping. They petitioned to reimpose a compulsory cartel because they said if you don't have a compulsory cartel, then you have efficient business will outcompete other business, you wind up with a monopoly, and the consumer would suffer. The same argument. In order to eliminate a possible future monopoly where the consumers would suffer, we should make the consumers suffer right now with an inefficient monopoly. Again, unfortunately, it didn't work. I can't imagine anybody really believe. My problem is I can't imagine people making these arguments with a straight face or anybody believing them or anybody bothering to report them without laughing in their faces. At any rate, these are common arguments in favor of compulsory cartel or in favor of outlawing efficient businesses coming up. So there were special taxes on department stores. There were special licensing requirements or whatever. And finally, they made it. Another thing which happened about the same time, around 1900 or so, which also was met with tremendous hysteria, you can't believe it, was the mail order concept. You don't have to go to the store. You just send away. You have a catalog, Sears Roebuck, of course, the famous one, Montgomery Ward. You have samples, you send orders by mail. met with fantastic hysteria. All the retail stores said, my God, we'll create a monopoly, drive us all out of business, there's unfair competition, outlaw them, tax them. And they organized, for example, special, they said this is a terrible thing, because they don't employ salesmen. Now get this, one of the big arguments was that Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward are unfair because they don't employ salesmen. So that means they have a smaller, lower cost. Notice, this, 30 years before that, they were attacking any firm which employed a salesman as being somehow evil. Now, if you didn't employ salesmen, it's a terrible, unfair thing. And so they organized, retailers organized mail order catalog burning parties, bonfires, where they have trade at home clubs. Because this way, of course, if you're a New Yorker or a Philadelphian, you're buying from Sears catalog in Illinois, it means you're not trading from a local store. You're somehow injuring a local economy. They had trade at home clubs, they had organized burning of Sears Roebuck catalog, bonfires, they tossed in the Sears and Monkey Ward catalog. Totally crazed. And they set up special taxes against mail order. So anyway, after the mail order business, the final grudging, and it took a long time for the acceptance of the mail of Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward. They were considered monopolists, unfair competitors, they don't have any salesmen. It's like peddlers are unfair, they don't pay rent. Well, so what? If you can get away without paying rent, great. You're willing to walk around the streets and brave the rain and snow and so forth, super. Anything which is best for the consumers is best for the economy. And another big threat, which came in around the same time as the mail order business, was the department store. I guess I mentioned it at the very end. The department store, terrible thing. They have 8 floors instead of 1. God proclaimed that only 1 floor, every store should be on 1 floor. You have 8 floors and everything is in 8 floors, it's a terrible thing. And a group of retailers convened in 1895 and condemned department stores. And they said it would, quote, result in oppression of the public by suppressing competition and causing the consumer in the end to pay higher prices and ultimately create a monopoly. I mentioned last time this is a typical argument of monopolists. They're trying to get a government to give you a cartel. The argument against efficient competitors is that eventually you'll have a monopoly. Well, the answer is, first of all, wait. Don't impose an inefficient cartel now because you might have an efficient monopoly 20 years from now. Wait for the efficient monopoly and see if they raise prices. They almost never do because then they'll worry about new competitors coming in. So it's typical nonsense. At any rate, after that, as the department store was accepted, as mail orders were accepted, around the 1920s came a new dread innovation, chain stores. Chain stores, my God, chain stores are a monopoly, terrible, they squeeze out all these lovable mom-and-pop stores. There'll be no single stores left, every corner of the wall. When I was growing up in the 1930s, it was a big cry by liberals and leftists, break up A&P. A&P then was a big, quote, monopolist, unquote, chain stores. They had the biggest chain of groceries. And they could charge lower prices because they were buying in quantity. They'd buy, 10,000 units of something instead of 12. And so as a result, they would got discounts, quantity discounts. They'd be cheaper, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, there were also some problems with A&P. Namely, they didn't give credit. They didn't deliver as much as small stores do. You have a trade-off. A smaller mom, a so-called mom-and-pop store, they know you, they give you credit, and they'll be a lot looser about charging, about enforcing it. They'll deliver later and so forth and so on. So at any rate, break up A&P. A&P is so big they're going to drive all the stores out of business, all this nonsense. What actually happened in practice was that when the supermarket boom came in, first of all, in World War II, the big change with frozen food, the big invention of frozen food, and second of all, the supermarket concept where you have, because before that, A&P, which they were like mom and pop stores in the sense that you had a counter, you went to ask the guy, I want, 5 cans of so-and-so. So the whole idea of a self-service supermarket comes in after World War II. And A&P, not being used to this, were the last guys to convert, the last people to really understand the supermarket concept. As a result, the average A&P in New York, first of all, A&P is sort of almost went bankrupt, or went quasi-bankrupt. They're down the tubes. They didn't have to be broken up by government coercion. They broke up themselves by inefficiency. And even now, you have an A&P supermarket. Those few that are left, they're crummily organized. They're dirty. They have boxes piled up in the aisles. They have linoleum floors instead of what they have wooden floors, excuse me, instead of the tiles. They're just crummy. And they're old-fashioned. They weren't up with the current innovation. So, as a matter of fact, many states and cities had chain store taxes deliberately to inflict taxes to try to cripple chain stores. And there are, my professor An economics professor told me about Switzerland, and that's the same way in the rest of the continent. In Switzerland, where people are, and due to the ideology that chain stores are evil, they actually walk 10 miles to go to a mom and pop store rather than patronize a chain store because they think it's somehow evil. So at any rate, all this stuff this stuff was swept away largely. And then came the supermarkets, and nobody says break up AMP anymore. But you couldn't believe how many left-wing and liberal writers in the 1930s and 40s were urging the breakup of AMP. Terrible thing, monopoly. First, it was selling cheap stuff and selling good stuff to the consumer at cheap prices. After World War II, the latest thing in retailing, which also got big hysteria, was a discount house, which came in the 1950s, I believe. heroic discount house, which broke the law. Because of the Clayton Act, which came in 1913, as we'll see later, and the Robinson-Patman Act, which came in the 1930s, imposed a so-called fair trade, a great work of cartel. Fair trade law. Maybe hear the word fairness, by the way, in economics. Guard your pocketbook. Reach, guard your wallet. So fair trade meant it shouldn't compete. In other words, this is a so-called resale price maintenance. And once again, the poor, beloved mom-and-pop stores have to be saved. This was done by trade associations of mom-and-pop retail stores. So you don't have to be a big business to be politically powerful. You can have a lot of retail stores all band together in a trade association. They have a big clout because they have a lot of votes. The resale price maintenance means that the thou shalt not sell this certain product below a certain amount. In other words, you push the price above the free market level by a cartel arrangement. You push the supply to the left, keep out competition, and raise the price. This is a typical cartel situation. A cartel enforced by the government, federal government, because nobody else can do it, state government, federal government. If you have 100,000 retailers, they can't form a successful cartel without the government imposing it. So retail price maintenance, officially the manufacturer imposed it. Actually, of course, it was the retailer. The retailers would want to keep, let's say, electric shaver. A classic case was Sunbeam, which was a slave to the retail cartel. They have an electric shaver in those days. I don't use an electric shaver. In those days, a typical price would be about $30, $25. I suppose it's a lot more now. But anyway, so let's say the retailers will go to Sunbeam and say, look, Mr. Sunbeam, we will not buy your product, et cetera, blah, 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 unless you impose a resale price maintenance, say $30. Now, almost always the manufacturer doesn't care. As long as he sells the product to the wholesaler or the jobber, he doesn't care what the retailer charges. It's not his concern. But the law, the resale price maintenance law, said as follows. See, a manufacturer can make a contract. If I'm Mr. Sunbeam, I can make a contract with a retailer saying, thou shalt not sell this shaver for less than $30. But that would mean like 100,000 contracts. Nobody wants to go through this nonsense. So the resale price maintenance law said that Mr. Sunbeam makes a contract with one retailer who imposes a minimum price of $30, and every other retailer is bound by it. In other words, it's extending contract. The statute is saying all he has to do is to sign one contract with Joe Jones somewhere, and it supplies across the board through the whole country, but nobody can sell this thing for less than $30. And this of course was imposed upon Sunbeam by the retail association. This is true for most products, appliances, household appliances, vitamins, drugs, of course, even more so, liquor, which is resale price maintenance on the state governments. So what happened, this meant that prices were much higher than they should have been. There's a whole cartel screwing the consumer. This is in the name, of course, of the welfare state. This, by the way, is the welfare state in action. There's a whole bunch of special interest groups screwing consumers and taxpayers and making them think they're really benefiting. So what finally happened is the rise of the discount house, a heroic group of illegal black market sellers. In particular, in New York, the classic ones are Masters House and Corvettes, which just recently went bankrupt for other reasons. Corvettes and Masters, the whole thing was geared as we now. Of course, now there are discount houses all over the place. The discount house was able to sell way below the fixed market price, because they have very low costs. The thing is, in the old days, not so much anymore. I mean, nowadays you can't get a salesman in New York to wait on you. If there are salesmen at all, as you well know. The customer is considered to be an intrusion on the valuable leisure time of the clerks. You know, the clerks are yucking it up. Either no clerks at all, no salesmen, also yucking it up over coffee. And any customer is an unwelcome intrusion. At any rate, in the old days, used to be a lot of service. Okay, you go into a department store or whatever, appliance store, rugs or whatever. You got a lot of personal service. So Masters and Corvette cut out personal service at all. You just have price tags, and you just get the product, and you take it out, wait online, and buy it, as you do now at 47th Street Photo and other places. In other words, it's the idea of no frills, no service retailing. So if you know what you want, it's a great thing to do. So if you know you want a Sunbeam shave mat, I'd like to shave, you just go, you stand online, you pay the discount price. This was illegal, because they were violating, and consciously violating, at least the price minimum, the retail price maintenance law. They'd sell it, huh? Well, they just did it, and it was heroic because everybody started buying it. They sell for $20, something like that. Yeah, they didn't make a contract. The contract was only with somebody else, right? One store. They didn't violate a contract. They violated the resale price maintenance law, which said that one contract applies to everybody. Yeah. They're breaking the law. No, they weren't breaking any contract. They made no contract. I mean, they just bought a Sunbeam. That's right. They broke the law. Yeah. No. Well, they took them to court. Obviously, the Sunbeam people and particularly, of course, the retail price trade association took them to court. They fought it. They took it all the way to Supreme Court. Supreme Court finally decided the law was unconstitutional. It was a magnificent decision. It was somewhere, I guess, the late 50s or 60s. In other words, it was a constitutional test, and finally broke the resale price maintenance law. It was a great day for the consumer. And after that, the whole thing collapsed. The whole price structure collapsed. And then we started getting discounts all over the place. And then now everything is discount. I mean, you have 47th Street Photo. I mean, list price is sort of a joke. One great thing about New York, even though the consumer sovereignty is not exactly in order, you can get stuff much cheaper here than you can anyplace else. I mean, this 47th Street Photo, you get electronic stuff much, much cheaper than list price is sort of a joke here. If you go to other places in the country, they pay less price. They don't know any better. And there's no discount house unless they get a catalog. Yeah, of course. So the whole concept of the discount, the no-frills discount store, is a magnificent one. And now just list price is just a sort of vague reference point. Nobody really takes it seriously. At any rate, of course, recently Corvette went out of business because they had no more function. In other words, after 20 years of bonanza, they finally wound up with, you know, ever since everybody else was discounting, there's no reason to go to Corvette more than any other place. They still had vitamins and drugs, I think, took a long time to go discount, although that happened too with health food stores. It wasn't too long ago, about 20 years ago, I went to get some vitamins at a drugstore in my neighborhood, and the guy asked me, the list price, this was Theragran, the list price was $9.50, insane price, okay? And very high, as part of this resale price maintenance, because drugs are especially regulated. They said, list price is $9.50. I said, I'd like to get some Theragran. He said, looked at me, he said, do you live in the neighborhood? A strange question you might think to ask. Why should they care whether I live in the neighborhood? And the reason is, of course, they were afraid I was the equivalent of a narc. And I was afraid I was a Gestapo, an espionage agent for the city regulatory, whatever the heck it is. It goes around and polices prices, used to police prices. Make sure you don't sell it below $9.50. I said, yes, I live in that. Yes, I've seen you in the neighborhood. And he sold me for $5.50, which is the true market price, in contrast to the crazed $9.50. So now, of course, it's all over the place. You don't have to be known in the neighborhood to buy cheap vitamins, because now the discounts are everywhere. It's magnificent. What a great victory for the consumer. We should hail Mr. Corvette, Mr. Master, whatever their names are. I think it was a Mr. Corvette, E.J. Corvette. Hail them for being pioneers in consumer freedom. And but again, of course, these were attacked bitterly by the retailers. They're destroying the fair prices. It's unfair competition. Whenever you hear the words unfair competition, again, watch out. Yeah. Liquor is. See, liquor is monopolized in the sense you can't open a liquor store. See, I couldn't open a liquor store. You have to get a liquor license. They're not issuing any new liquor licenses. You have to buy a liquor license from some guy's willing to sell. It's like a taxi industry. It's very tightly controlled. So you can't have a liquor store more than less than, I don't know, 150 feet or 150 yards or whatever, to some other liquor store. There's compulsory spacing. Everybody has a little monopoly turf. It's less regulated than it used to be. I'm not really sure what the latest thing is, but it's still heavily regulated. Very high taxes, of course, which keeps out competition, raises the cost, raises the price. I'm not sure. I don't know what the European situation. Usually, liquor is regulated everywhere, but I'm not sure what happened. I think so. It's not as bad as liquor, where it's all tightly. See, for example, in California, it's magnificent. You can buy liquor in the grocery stores. It doesn't have to be a special liquor store. It gets the license, muckety-muck license. So the liquor is much cheaper, of course, and much more competitive. Also, in Las Vegas, for example, grocery stores are open 24 hours a day, supermarkets. You can buy liquor. It's magnificent. 3 a.m. Well, and I guess they close the liquor up after about 1 o'clock or something. Shut down the liquor section. But anyway, it's much easier to buy it. How do they reach the airline? Oh, that was due to deregulation. That was that was in the late 70s, early 80s when the deregulation hit. You start having, because before that, you see, the rates were regulated by the Civil Aeronautics Board. And so the big airlines put in the Civil Aeronautics Board. And so, they kept the price, the rates way up, and they kept the competition way down. They assigned routes. Like Boston and New York route has to only be Eastern and things like that. So now, of course, the sky's the limit. Anybody can nip in any area. So, of course, the inefficient airlines started going bust, and new airlines came in with more competitive rates and then no frills and all the rest of it. The railroads have still not been deregulated. As a matter of fact, there's a woman now as head of the Interstate Commerce Commission, who's in favor of eliminating the Interstate Commerce Commission and deregulating all trucking and all the other thing they run, buses, I guess, but not railroads. She wants to keep railroad rates. So that's of course the thing that's been killing the railroad, all those regulations. So it's still.
LA, $230
Well, it's an interesting question. The railroads are purely subsidized. I mean, right now it's all the taxpayer pays for this stuff. And I think, according to a friend of mine who's in the transportation economist, I asked him the question, if all subsidies and all controls were eliminated, if you had entirely free markets in transportation, what would be used in different areas? Of course, you can't predict it, but his hunch was that basically you'd have for long mileage, long haul freight, you have railroads. They're best for long haul freight, like freight from New York to California or something. And for long haul passengers, of course, airlines. Right? And then for short haul, and that's for commuting stuff, buses for passengers and trucks for freight. Yeah. That would be about it. So I think that makes a lot of sense. So the whole railroads shouldn't be any short-term railroads. All kept up by a taxpayer for the benefit of a few wealthy people in Greenwich, Connecticut or something. Subsidized. Why should they be subsidized? Nobody's nuts. But anyway, that's the. They're trying to sell Amtrak now. At least one wing of the Reagan administration is trying to privatize, get rid of all this stuff. I don't think it'll be very successful, but at least they're talking about it, which is very unusual. Trying to sell Amtrak, even trying to sell a couple of dams. And it's an amazing thing when the government's trying to sell some dams, because there had been a dam propaganda now from about a century. Old dams are good per se, for some reason, even because they're there and they have this water flowing over them, that sort of thing. Fortunately, there's been sort of a rollback now and a reevaluation of the dam question, both by economists on the one side and environmentalists on the other. Of course, environmentalists are trying to save little fish or stuff like that. Anyway, it's sort of an anti-dam coalition between free market economists and environmentalists. That's kind of interesting.
Like,
pardon?
Violate security?
What is that?
Yeah.
Oh, no, no, you have to worry about that, because the producers are liable. See, if you have construction, after all, there's houses all the time, and they're not government. They're private houses being built, private offices, so they don't collapse. If they did collapse, the guys would be liable. I mean, the guys who use unsafe equipment could go to jail for 20 years or something, plus you know, plus pay through the nose. So they have an economic incentive not to bill unsafe stuff. Much more than with the government, because the government's never liable. The government can always say, well, geez, it's due to somebody else's fault. So, I think on a safety question, the private people are much more responsible because they can get hit in the pocketbook. They use shoddy equipment and stuff. on the whole retail question, we have a whole history of, and each time the finally innovation triumphs, I mean, efficiency finally triumphs after a long hysterical attack. And now I don't know of any recent big development. There's the peddlers, of course. I'm still trying to get rid of peddlers. That's I guess it's like forever. At any rate. you can bet your bottom dollar whatever new big thing comes in the retail industry will be combated by a whole bunch of people who are now competing against it. One interesting thing, since we're getting to labor in a minute, is that one of the big charges the leftists have always made against capitalism is that capitalism took the masses out of their beloved home. They used to work at home. In other words, in the old days, if you're a weaver, let's say you had your equipment at home, your loom in the basement, and you lived usually one hut. You, your family, and a loom, and a couple of pigs are all in one room. This is a traditional peasant hut. Anyway, so capitalism yanked these people out of their beloved huts and brought them into the factory where they had to stay there 8 hours or 10 hours a day or something. Of course, they got a lot more money, but somehow their soul was robbed, and they're alienated from their labor. So capitalism brings about alienation and so forth and so on. So here we have a situation where there's a counter drive. In other words, with the computer and stuff like that, a lot of people now can work at home and are working at home. And so the leftists are now bellyaching about that. Terrible thing, they can undercut union wage scales. They don't join unions, obviously. If you're working at home, you're not going to join a union. They're trying to outlaw that. So the same people who are attacking capitalism for alienating people from their home are now trying to force them to work somewhere else to prevent them from working at home. One more contradiction in the internal struggle. Anyway, now I get to labor and the labor situation in the late 19th century. There's been a lot, and most historians, it's not true of Hughes, but in general, most historians traditionally overweighted the whole labor, whole union problem. The numbers, we'll see in a minute, the number of people joining unions is very small throughout. it's of course dramatic, it's newsworthy if you have a strike, but it really didn't mean that much in the overall picture. Again, in the overall picture, what happens is that wage rates, real wage rates, in other words, wage rates corrected for changes in price, went way up all during the late 19th century. Here's one way of looking at it. This is the average wage rate, average daily wages in industry, all industry. It's of course a rough figure, but it gives you, I think, a good idea. But average daily wages in all industry. Because a lot of historians used to claim that workers were somehow oppressed during the Industrial Revolution in the United States. You can see what kind of oppression it was. In 1865, we set wages equal to 100. In other words, there's an index where the average wage in 1865 was equivalent to 100. In 1891, in money terms, okay, this is the money wage rates, this is going up by 13%. In other words, there's now 13% increase in money terms from 1865 to 1891, okay, plus 13%. The cost of living in the same time, don't forget, it was deflation this whole period. In other words, prices kept falling throughout because the increase in production of goods and services was much greater every year than the increase in the money supply. You have increase in money supply was fairly small. Increase in production was tremendous, and so you had a big drop. In other words, you had this sort of thing. This is a price on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis. This is supply and this is demand. Supply kept increasing a lot, overcoming any increases in money supply. So prices kept falling this whole period. So the cost of living went from 100 to 69. In other words, there's a 31% drop in prices. Can you imagine a 31% drop in prices over this 26-year period? Like a drop of slightly more than 1% a year. So overall, in real terms, the average daily real wage Okay. Correcting for deflation this time. Went up by 64%, 164. So we had, in other words, something like 2% a year or 3% a year increase in real wages steadily for these 26-year period. It really goes on until 1900. In addition to that, the number of hours a day worked, the average hour a day. Don't forget, in those days, people worked a lot. I mean, worked very hard. They worked 64 hours a week or something. And the hours dropped in this period from 11 hours a day on the average to 10. So you had, in other words, in addition to a 64% increase in real wages, you have something like another extra amount, since you're an additional 10% per hour wage rate. So it's like 74%. In this whole period, take the union membership rate. You take the labor force, I mean the number of people working or seeking work, total labor force, in 1897 was 26 million. And the number of the total union membership in 1897 was 440,000, which is 1.7%. That was about the norm. That's not unusual, this whole period. That means from 1880s until 1914, approximately, union membership was about 2%. Range, I will see, it fluctuated a little, to some extent. But basically, it was a very small proportion of labor force. It wasn't really worth talking about very much. Huh? Total union membership. In other words, this is the total labor force, number of people who are working. 26 million. Of that, 440,000 were union members, which makes it about 1.7% of the total.
Isn't there some deflation these days?
No, there's no deflation. They're talking about deflation, but prices are still going up by about 3% a year.
And the price of oil
went down? Yeah, the price of oil fell. On the other hand, if you look at the overall picture, prices are still going, cost of living is still going up by 3% a year.
Isn't
it great economy to fight for? No. It's one important price. It's not the whole story. There's lots of prices going on, and that's just one aspect of it. And the fact that the material prices keep falling, on the other hand, general prices, you know, overall cost of living goes up is a sign. And don't forget, during the 1950s, the government tried to keep their target was that prices should go up no more than 2% a year. They figured that was the limit of inflation. And anything above 2% is considered a terrible thing. Now, 3.5% is considered to be no inflation at all, which shows we've been desensitized from inflation. It's not that inflation is eliminated, just we don't think there is any, because it's better, 3.5% is better than 13%. I suppose it is, but it's not the whole picture. So you have to watch that. The problem of desensitization to inflation. It weakens people's will to do something about it. Can unions come in? First of all, before the Civil War, there's no real room for unions because most people were not employed. Most people were self-employed. The standard situation was to be self-employed. If you're a manufacturing, it was very small, like a small barrel maker or bicycle, barrel maker or horseshoer or something like that. You usually have the master craftsman who's employed, owns his own shop. And then a journeyman, an employee, and maybe an apprentice. That's it. So even though there were outfits that call themselves labor groups, they were not really labor in our sense. They weren't really particularly employed. So only after the Civil War, with factories, you have a large number of employed people. So what first happens is that the first organization to try to organize laborers was the Knights of Labor, founded in 1869, which is essentially a socialist outfit. And since the Knights of Labor believe in labor solidarity above all things, they didn't see the need for any kind of separate unions. In other words, what they did is everybody, you just join up geographically. In other words, everybody's a member of the Knights of Labor. If you show up, it doesn't matter what you're working at. You simply become a geographical member. Let's say if downtown Brooklyn here would be local 786 or something like that, you just join up. It doesn't matter what your occupation is. You become a member of Knights of Labor Local 786. So obviously, since there was no, since everybody was amalgamated, the one, it was called one big union, the concept of one big union. Because everybody was amalgamated in one big union, there was no collective bargaining going on, because there's nothing, nobody to bargain with. There's no committee of steel workers or something like that. So this really, really went national by 1878, so it existed in a very small amount. And it reached a peak in 1886, and by 1890 it had totally collapsed. In other words, it was a big sort of a flurry, and bingo, the whole thing was over. And with the collapse of the Knights of Labor, some smart, shrewd union people began to come to the conclusion that there must be another way. There's something wrong with Knights of Labor. It didn't work. And one of the reasons it didn't work is because it was one big union. Because there's nothing for them to do except preach socialism. There's no direct activity. And so, as a result, was founded another group based on a whole different concept. And this is the concept of the craft union. The idea of the craft union is to control labor supply. In other words, to try to take a situation, an occupation, usually skilled craft, where there's a natural limitation on entry. In other words, see, everybody can be a ditch digger. Anybody's got shoulders can be a ditch digger. So you can't organize ditch diggers. This is the concept. You can only organize people who are skilled, very small supply of skilled craftsmen. One ideal now, for example, would be stonemasons. There are almost no stonemasons left. And eight or nine in the country, and usually elderly Italians, and that's it. If you have eight or nine people in stonemasons, you can easily organize them because, well, for various reasons. One is a skilled craft, a small, limited entry. Okay. That's one reason. If you take a skilled craft, which is limited entry and also requires a lot of skill to become a stonemason, you can't just walk in and become a stonemason. You have to be an apprentice for 10 years or something. Okay. So you have things like stonemasons, you have things like cigar band workers, usually not mechanized. You see, in other words, in most cases, these are skilled craftsmen, mechanics in the old-fashioned sense. You fit the stuff together, you fit parts together. You have mechanics, you have cigar workers, hand cigar workers, glass blowers, another occupation which I'm afraid going forever with mechanization and things like that. No, it's still skilled craft. We have a limited entry. Only a few people can join it, can be in it. And two, another very important thing is the demand curve for the labor is inelastic. In other words, you have this sort of situation. if the demand curve is elastic, okay, this is a demand for, let's say, ditch diggers, elastic. So if you form a ditch diggers union and insist on raising the wage rate, you will disemploy a whole bunch of them. In other words, this is how many people will be hired, demand curve. On the y-axis, you now have wage rate. So if you push the wage rate up from here to here, you disemploy, you know, half the number of ditch diggers, or more than half. If you have a heavy unemployment, you'll break the union, because the union, the guys will just go out there and undercompete the union, and the union will be smashed. So you have to have, in order for the union to be successful in pushing up wage rates, have inelastic demand curve, where if you push up the wage rate for, say, stonemasons, you might disemploy one person. You have 10 people employed, you might disemploy one guy. So in other words, you're trying to have a situation where you always will have unemployment as a result of unions pushing up wage rates. So at least if it's a small amount of unemployment, the union can get away with it. And at best for the union, of course, if you don't disappoint anybody, simply don't employ a new person coming in, like somebody would have been employed at the age of 21. He's no longer employed. So the unemployment is not visible. Okay? It's even better from the point of view of the union. So if you can do that, if you can have that an inelastic demand curve and a limited entry, then you have the conditions ready to form a successful craft union. Okay? And one of the reasons it gives you an inelastic demand curve is a small proportion of the labor force. In other words, just a small number of people. Small proportion. So these are the outfits that have of economic power. In other words, can push out wage rates at the expense of unemployment. A small proportion, because then it's not a significant part of the payroll. You don't raise costs for the employer very much. To give you an example, I think a classic example which I use in one of my micro classes, not unions, in Poly here, we used to have two big unions. We had the staff workers union, the big union relative to Poly. Okay? We have 200 members of something, the staff union, which belonged to the retail clerks union. And the faculty, which used to belong to the AUP, which is a mass union of 250 whatever faculty members. They had no power at all. They made a lot of noise because they're more people. And they yelled a lot. They had no power. They couldn't get a damn thing. Okay? Because if the faculty got a 50% wage increase, it would bankrupt Poly. Because that would mean a huge increase in cost. On the other hand, you had two or three boiler tenders belonging to the very teeny but important boiler tenders union. And so I remember years ago, about 18 years ago or something, the boiler tenders union went out on strike. And then we had big unions. The faculty was a big union then and so forth. They went to the boilers and they had one picket somewhere around the corner where nobody sees them. And they went up to them and said, "You want us to have solidarity? You want us to picket with you?" They said, "No, leave us alone. Leave. Buzz off. We're not interested in worker solidarity." And so, sure enough, it was a formal strike. 2 weeks or 3 weeks by these three guys, the boilers and the union. And finally, Poly settles after about 3 weeks. Gives them a 50% wage increase. Because if you probably can afford to get a 50% wage increase to three people, not to 400 people. Okay? That's the difference. So you have then, in other words, an inelastic demand curve, small proportion of the payroll, and small entry. Because that's too, probably the boiler tenders are probably fairly skilled occupation. You can't just walk in and become a boiler tender. So with these conditions set, you don't have a situation for a successful craft union. So the unions that have the economic power, in other words, the power to raise wage rates above the market level, are not the large unions with lots of members and make lots of noise and got a lot of publicity in the paper. These are the small little unions of the interstices of the market where they can get in, cut employment and raise wage rates without too much evident disruption. Now what happens, of course, to the people means that people can't get into the occupation. You can't become a boiler tender very easily. Tight control over the craft. These unions usually have very tight control. They're usually considered racist because they're not really racist in the correct sense. They really, what happens is, in the standard situation is you can't become a union member, say, electrician in Hoboken. Electrician's union, a very powerful union. You can't become an electrician unless you're the son or nephew of an existing union member. Of course, nowadays, I suppose, with affirmative action or whatever, they've probably broken that a little bit. But this was a classic situation. You can't become a member of the union unless you're the son or nephew of an existing union member. Well, I mean, this cuts out, of course, other races. It also cuts out non-relatives. All non-relatives need not apply. And, of course, you can't become an electrician in Hoboken unless you're a member of the union. It's a virtually closed shop situation. Your house is bombed or whatever it is. It's tight control over this little area of the labor force. So this means the wage rates of electricians are pushed up at the expense of who? Not so much the employer, to some extent, but largely to the extent of other workers who would like to be electricians but can't do it. They have to become supermarket clerks or whatever. And this, in other words, move out of Hoboken. And so the result is an increase in the supply curve for other occupations which don't have tight unions. So this means a fall in wage rates for supermarket clerks, filling station attendants or whatever. So what you have then, the way unions get their power is not by exploiting employers particularly, but by exploiting other workers. By exploiting non-union workers or workers with less powerful unions who can't maneuver this way. They've got a lot more people that can't control the supply that much and so forth and so on. So what you had in this whole period, 1880s to 1914, was a situation where unions are a very small proportion, like 2% or so, and they only flourish in skilled craft situations. And the theoretician of this, the practitioner was Samuel Gompers, who was the head of the Cigar Workers Union, who became head of the American Federation of Labor, formed in 1886, as the exemplar of this kind of the craft concept, head of the American Federation of Labor. The American Federation of Labor, the AFL, had no power itself. It was really sort of a propaganda effort. The real power belongs, and still belongs, by the way, to the National Union, the National Cigar Workers Union, or whatever it is. And there are national unions and then there are locals. Usually the national union has total power over locals, and each local. And then they're part of the Federation, but the Federation itself only endorses candidates and they make speeches. They don't really do anything. They don't have any concrete power. So the National Union can leave the AFL anytime it wants to, and it often has. yeah. Well, that's a guild. Yeah, so not technically called a union because they're self-employed usually, but they're certainly they act as a monopolistic guild.
Sure,
it's very similar.
They reduce supply
themselves. Beg pardon? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure. But they get the government to reduce the supply for them. We'll see how that happened in 1910 with the Flexner report. How the doctors they were able to get control of medicine, and especially licensing in medical schools and hospitals, and thereby kicking out all, reducing supply tremendously. They had to use the government to do it. We're now talking about unions who do this without the government, you see. In other words, we're able to have a successful kind of union without government support or right. It's very limited, as I say. It's also limited to craft unions, and most of these unions were, we'll have a little break in a minute, but most of these unions were concentrated in certain industries or occupations. Okay, there were the building trades, what's known as the building construction unions. Carpenters, joiners, masons, and machinists and so forth. All these things were, construction of course has always been the most reactionary part of the economy, the least most backward, least innovative. And largely it's because construction is not a very competitive industry between cities or between locales. In other words, if you're a garment firm, let's say, if New York City is unionized and pushes the cost of garment production way up, the garment plant closes and goes to West Virginia or something, starts there and competes with the clothing produced in New York. But in construction, you don't really have that kind of competition. If New York City is unionized, New York City construction unionized, you don't just move to Chicago construction firm. In other words, construction doesn't compete that closely with other cities. So since construction is sort of geographically monopolistic in a sense, it leaves room for this kind of skilled craft unionism. So building trades were heavily unionized throughout. In the railroad industry, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, which was known as the aristocracy of the railroad industry, the guys were, guys blowing the whistle there in the cab. But they were the only ones that were unionized before the ICC came in. The ICC came in 1886. This was expanded to the skilled craft and railroad, the so-called Big Four Brotherhoods. These are known as the Brotherhoods. These were the engineers, the firemen, I forget who the other two guys were. Two Big Four skilled craft. The non-skilled railroad people, like the guys that are the sort of janitorial types of reporters, were not unionized. These were the skilled craft in the railroad industry, and these only really came in with the ICC. With the ICC, by the way, since the ICC essentially cartelized the railroad industry, it permitted broad and racial discrimination into the railroads. Before 1886, there were strong black contingent and railroad engineers, firemen, and all the rest of it. In the South and other places. Blacks were mostly in the South then. As soon as the ICC came in, the railroads were cartelized, they didn't have to worry about being profitable and so forth. Blacks were systematically kicked out of the top jobs in the railroad industry, engineers, firemen, and so forth, pushed down to the porters and janitors. And then the various skilled crafts, cigar, dompers comes out of the cigar workers, glass blowers, etc. But really, and the only other one is really was anthracite coal. Anthracite coal, contrasted by bituminous coal, which is gets most of the publicity. But bituminous coal is found everywhere. I mean, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, all over the place. Anthracite coal is limited to a very small section around Scranton, around eastern Pennsylvania. So therefore, it's fairly easy to monopolize it, to unionize it, because it's a very small geographical monopoly. And so you get one union in a little area, and that's it. So they were successfully unionized. And that's really about it. There's not too much else. They tried it all the time with garment firms to unionize that, especially because they're ideologically devoted. They're immigrants from Eastern Europe. They're devoted to unionism per se and socialism. They couldn't succeed very well, even with that ideological devotion. Within that framework, also what happened, if you take a graph on the y-axis, percentage of union membership, percentage of labor force, okay, union membership. And this is time. say 1880s to 1914, and this whole period, which would go from about 1% to 6%, something like that. The 6% would be in the business cycle boom period. So you had a boom, a boom situation. This means the demand for labor would go up, so wage rates would tend to go up. In that situation, people would join unions, so they thought the unions would claim responsibility. Hey, we got your higher wage rates, even though the cause was not unions, the cause was the boom. So union membership would go up, say, from 1% to 6% in the boom period. As soon as the recession came, and the demand for labor fell, the unions would be smashed, because they try to keep the wage rates up, and of course, massive unemployment, and unions would be broken, because the workers would simply compete, undercut union wage rates to get jobs, and go right back down to 1%. This was the classic situation during the pre-1917 period, from 1886 to 1917. This is a traditional situation. A very small proportion unionized, mostly during boom periods, which then recede in recessions, and limited to very small skilled crafts, usually concentrated in things like building trade, railroad brotherhoods, and emphasized coal. The only other union before 1930s, before the New Deal came in, which was successfully unionized, which doesn't meet these conditions, is a musicians union. And apparently, my professor who taught me labor economics from whom I imbibed his great truths, couldn't understand that. He said, well, musicians are crazy anyway. That was the only explanation. I think probably a better explanation is that musicians are willing to be 90% unemployed, which most of them are. In other words, they love music so much. It's something like acting, too. Acting is, of course, not heavily unionized, but they're willing to be unemployed most of the time, be waiters and so forth, waiting for their big chance, or waiting to play music once. And most occupations, they're not willing to settle for that, obviously, not willing to sit still for this, a 90% unemployment rate. So generally, that was the concentration. Unions were not that important, and they were craft unions. They gave up any kind of idea of changing the world. What they wanted was higher wage rates and better working conditions. That was it. And it was collective bargaining on this local level. And the theoretician, Samuel Gomper, is a great practitioner in this. The theoretician was Felix Perlman, who wrote such an economist for Gomper, who wrote a book on the theory of labor unions in the United States, which propounded this doctrine. And the Marxist myth of worker solidarity. There is no worker solidarity. It's a lot of nonsense. And as you see, the craft union succeeded by essentially shafting other workers who are not skilled craftsmen. And also on the national level, this is what happens. In other words, the national level, the people who call for immigration restrictions were, of course, the union. In other words, by keeping out immigrants, you push the supply curve to the left and you raise wage rates of workers who are behind this barrier. And of course, in the long run, this means the International Division of Labor is hurt and all sorts of other stuff. But usually, these special interests don't care about the long run. They're interested in short-term exclusion of competition. America was built on free immigration. One of the great things about America was it was no restrictions on immigration. And with immigration, we had the greatest industrial success, the greatest industrial growth, greatest growth in standard of living. However, union forces in favor of limiting immigration so as to keep out competitors, worker competitors. In other words, workers compete with each other just as employers compete with each other. Workers don't compete with employers. So the key thing is that restrictions on labor migration or advance are almost always lobbied for by other labor groups. In the case of the United States, the first restriction on immigration comes in the late 19th century with bitter hatred of Chinese and restrictions on Chinese immigration. The important thing, again, about labor migration is that economics and race is a powerful combination. Racism by itself is unimportant. Racism by itself is simply a sort of a social thing. You don't get into a certain club. Who the hell cares? But when you combine race with economics, and it comes to somebody's economic interest to keep out Chinese or Italians or whatever, then you have a powerful combination, and the two things reinforce each other, which is what happens with immigration restriction in the United States. So the first people that get the force of this were the Chinese immigrants. The Chinese began to migrate to the United States around 1850, and they did extremely well, mostly, of course, on the West Coast, as you might expect. They did extremely well. They were usually efficient, industrious, all the rest of the virtues of the labor force, thrifty, came in with almost no capital. And immediately, of course, white workers began to agitate to keep them out, kick them out. Terrible thing, they're evil, they're coolies, whatever it is. It's because they were being outcompeted, indeed, by better workers, and they didn't like it, and they used the racial weapon. to try to exclude them. The first thing, the Chinese settled en masse in western mining districts in the mountain states and did extremely well. They take an abandoned mine, like a crummy mine, and do very well with it, not making it profitable. So the white miners began to agitate very quickly by 1852 to prevent Chinese immigration, to kick them out. And they used force, both private and governmental, to kick the Chinese out of the mining districts. They lynched Chinese, they burned their houses down, and so forth and so on, and they state and local governments would pass laws prohibiting Chinese from entering the mining districts, from working in the mines. It's unbelievable to think of it. About 20 or 30 years later, the Supreme Court declared most of these laws unconstitutional. By that time, it was too late. Really, the effect was immediate. So there's whole horror stories about this. There's violence was used, and say state laws were used to especially tax Chinese mines and so forth and so on. Then that way, by violence, both governmental and private, the Chinese were driven out of the mining areas and went to the cities like San Francisco and railroad work. Of course, once again, the white workers started bellyaching about Chinese railroad workers, except when work became dangerous, when you had to go up mountain grades, etc. And they said, okay, we'll allow the Chinese to do that. And the people leading the parade, as a theoretical level, so to speak, leading the parade of anti-Chinese exclusion and agitation were the Knights of Labor, and those first the Knights of Labor, and then the American Federation of Labor later on. Terence Powderly, usually considered by liberal historians, left-wing historians, a heroic left-wing figure. I guess in a sense he was certainly a left-wing figure, not heroic. Who was the head of the Knights of Labor. Terence Powderly called for the total elimination of all Chinese in the United States. Kick them all out. So this is Powderly. The Knights of Labor adopted this as one of their big planks. there was murders of Chinese driving them out of mining areas. In 1877, the Working Man's Party of California, which is a labor party of workers and unions, was a fairly strong party, a big third party in California for about 30 years. It was founded by Dennis Kearney, who was a powerful political figure, came out for progressive income tax, welfare state, and kicking all Chinese out of the United States. As he put it, quote, "We propose to rid the country of cheap Chinese labor as soon as possible and by all means in our power," by any means necessary would be the current phrase. They also marked as public enemies and listed in the newspapers or whatever all employers who would refuse to fire Chinese workers. There was also legal persecution in California of Chinese workers. In California, for example, in 1870, outlawed the employment of any Chinese in public works projects. 2 years later, they outlawed prevented Chinese from owning any real estate or getting business licenses. I'd say about 20, 30 years later, the Supreme Court declared this unconstitutional. They put special taxes on Chinese. What they do is things like this. For example, Chinese had less capital than other workers. They started with virtually nothing. So San Francisco, for example, charged an $8 license fee per year for horse-drawn laundry wagons, but $60 for foot laundry men. In other words, Chinese weren't wealthy enough yet to have horses and wagons. They carry the stuff on foot, laundry on foot. So there'd be specially high taxes on foot laundry men. Same thing with vegetable peddlers, where basket carriers, Chinese would have baskets. They spent $40 a year against $8 a year for a license fee for those who have wagons. Now this, remember, $40 meant something like $1,000 now, so they're quite high. Also, in order to crush Chinese businesses, they have maximum cubic foot laws for, say, laundries, so that a cubic air ordinance, so you couldn't have less than 500 cubic feet of air in any laundry. So most of the Chinese laundries were small, and this would outlaw Chinese laundries and for the benefit of white laundries. Also, there's a Q ordinance, California, at San Francisco area, where compulsory hair cutting. The Chinese used to wear pigtails, or Qs as it's called, and they compulsorily cut the hair cut the hair off. Eventually, of course, declared unconstitutional. Anyway, this goes on. There's a whole list of horror stories I have in this thing. Just on and on, endless. And again, the leaders in all this were first the Working Man's, the Knights of Labor, then the Working Man's Party in California, and then the craft unions. When the AFL gets strong in the 1880s, they pick up the cry. For example, in San Francisco, 40 labor unions in April 1880 set up the League of Deliverance, what they meant as the League of Deliverance from Chinese Americans. And the head of it was a socialist and a member of the Siemens Protective Union, which was a working man's party socialist group. They had 4,000 members in California, and they promoted a giant boycott. The idea is to boycott all goods made by Chinese labor, and boycott merchants who employ Chinese, who sell Chinese labor products. Matter of fact, the first example of a boycott in the United States was an anti-Chinese boycott. And the boycott tactic begins, by the way, with Samuel Gompers, whose white cigar workers were being outcompeted by large cigar firms used to employ Chinese labor, Chinese cigar labor. And they would outcompete the inefficient white cigar workers. So the Gompers comes up with a tactic of what was called the white label, now called the union label. We all know about union labels and clothing, etc. It was originally as a white label. And so cigars, for example, made in inefficient, high-cost, white worker plants had a white label, and of course the Chinese-made ones didn't. By the mid-1880s, 7/8 of the cigars in San Francisco, for example, were made by Chinese workers and low-cost plants. So the white label comes in, they form a white cigar makers association to lead the boycott along, of course, with the union. Again, an example of union industry cooperation. The white cigar workers combining with inefficient white cigar manufacturing firms, to try to boycott and crush the lower cost Chinese labor people. And of course, Gompers then takes the lead in Chinese exclusion, to try to keep Chinese from coming in and preferably to kick them out. In late 1885, and this pressure of the boycott, et cetera, the San Francisco large cigar firms agreed to fire all the Chinese workers and replace them with white workers. Another thing, in 1885, was a giant council of Congress in San Francisco of 64 Pacific Coast unions, including Knights of Labor, anarcho-communists, anarchists, Socialist Labor Party, and craft unions, all united on the idea of kicking out all Chinese from the United States, so certainly from San Francisco area. And the only disagreement was, should they be kicked out, should we give them 2 months to leave or 2 days? That was the range of opinion. The most extreme was the anarcho-communist Siemens Union, which called for kicking out Chinese immediately. At any rate, as the anarcho-communist leader said, by force is the only way to remove the coolie, and 20 days is enough to do it in. So he thought it was a big concession, it gives them 3 weeks. The state of California goes along with this by, one, preventing Chinese from becoming citizens, two, excluding Chinese children from public schools, three, trying to restrict Chinese immigration on a state level. At any rate, most of the agitation has ended in 1882 when the Congress, as a result of all this, passes the Chinese Exclusion Act, preventing all Chinese from coming in, further Chinese from coming in, mostly under union pressure and Californians. And of course, the unionists were disappointed that they did not kick out existing Chinese. There were about 100,000 Chinese Americans at that point. They did not go so far as to kick them out. Samuel Gompers, again, takes the lead. Just want to mention one of Samuel Gompers' officials, the AFL official, Hermann Gutstadt, wrote a pamphlet, and in those days the title used to be very long. You really didn't have to read the pamphlet, you just read the title and get the whole picture. The title of this pamphlet in 1902 was, but this was when the Chinese Exclusion Act was up for renewal, 20-year act, and wanted to agitate to keep it going. Some reasons for Chinese exclusion, meat versus rice. In other words, rice is somehow evil. meat versus rice, American manhood against Asiatic coolieism, which shall survive? At any rate, then the Japanese begin to emigrate by 1880 or so, and by 1900 they're going to come in. And then, of course, they start hysteria against the Japanese, especially in Los Angeles area. The same stuff goes on, the same people. Dennis Carney comes out of retirement in the 1890s to lead the idea of Japanese exclusion against, quote, another breed of Asiatic slaves, unquote. Again, the labor unions lead the parade, the San Francisco labor unions, Los Angeles, et cetera, et cetera. Same damn thing happens. It's just forming an Asiatic exclusion league to exclude Chinese and Japanese immigrants. As a matter of fact, the AFL refused charters to Japanese farm workers' unions because they were Japanese Americans. Samuel Gompers, refusing a charter to a sugar beet workers' union, said, quote, it's around 1905, Your union must guarantee that it will, under no circumstances, accept membership of any Chinese or Japanese. This is the great far-sighted humanistic labor movement. At any rate, the same stuff goes on. It's finally Japanese Exclusion Act, and so I just want to emphasize that the point of all this is not to just to repeat a horror story. The point is to demonstrate that exclusion, racial racism, and as an economic and political measure, comes from a blend of race and economics. In other words, a blend of economic privilege with then using whipping up racial sentiment as a way of doing it. And by the way, the same thing happened in South Africa. What's not realized in South Africa is the South African apartheid system was not put in by the Afrikaners or Boers. That was much later. It was put in originally by the white Anglo workers after World War I, when African workers began to rise up and become skilled laborers, rise up out of the unskilled and become foremen and things like that. And at that point, the white workers group got hysterical and said, we have to exclude Africans from being promoted. And a Communist Party of South Africa, by the way, which led this exclusion principle, organized a general strike in the early 1920s, the theme of which was to prevent all Africans from coming to skilled labor or foreman jobs. And the slogan was, white workers unite and fight for a better world. The Communist Party, of course, does not talk about this epoch in its history at this point. But anyway, the general strike won, and after that, the government of South Africa, in response to this, prevented blacks from rising up into skilled worker and foreman jobs. That really begins the whole apartheid. It began even before that with workers. That was one of the earliest examples. Okay, I want to get now to start with Teddy Roosevelt. The next time, talk about Teddy Roosevelt's beginning of Teddy Roosevelt's president. So I want to talk about Teddy Roosevelt's early career. Teddy Roosevelt, as you might expect, is one of my least favorite people in American history. I have many unfavorites. So Teddy is one of right up there on the top. I can't imagine too many people I dislike more than Teddy. At any rate, Teddy, for example, liked killing for its own sake. He loved war, he loved murder. Killing anybody, animals, people, doesn't make any difference. he didn't care who he killed either. He wanted any kind of war. It didn't matter who the war was against. Spain, England, France, doesn't make any difference. Germany, didn't matter. As long as there was war. At any rate, Teddy was, as I say, grew up in the Morgan ambit. His relatives were more the Oyster Bay. Roosevelt's were old Morgan. He goes to Harvard as a young lad and at Harvard College, and he marries Alice Lee, who was the daughter of George Cabot Lee, one of the top Boston Brahmins, one of the top, of course, all connected with the Morgan interests, and related to the Lees, the Higginsons, and the Cabots, the top Boston financial aristocracy.